To better your best and your world, you need to dig deep and grow. Join us as top experts, leaders, and creators uncover powerful insights to help you grow in life and in work. And now, your host, Michael McAvoy. Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Dig Deep Grow. This is Michael McAvoy, your host, and Dig Deep Grow is the show dedicated to helping you better your best and your world. Today, we're going to be talking about the predictability of people and how you can take advantage of that in your life. Now, taking advantage isn't a bad thing, as you'll find out. We're going to be talking to William Poundstone about his new book called Rock Breaks Scissors. So we'll just get started right away. And this is a fascinating book. I've had a look at it, and I have a bunch of questions that I'm going to ask William. But let me bring you on, William. Thanks for joining us on the show today.
Yes, good to be with you.
So first question is, I was curious when I saw the title, and I think everybody is who's watching or listening right now. Why don't you tell me, where does the title Rock Breaks Scissors come from?
Yeah, well, of course, it comes from the childhood game of rock, paper, scissors, where you throw one of three signs simultaneously with another kid, and there's a rule for determining who wins. Rock breaks scissors, scissors cuts paper, paper covers rock. And I think most people think of that game as being, you know, just chance. But they have tournaments for rock, paper, scissors, and some people are very good at it. And I actually interviewed a number of these people for the book, and they have a whole psychology of how they can pick up on unconscious patterns in an opponent and use that to win. And in a very simple form, that's really a perfect example of what I talk about throughout the book, because this is something that has really been studied by psychologists quite a bit. It's taken on a lot of importance in the digital age where, you know, Amazon, iTunes, websites like that are trying to predict what products you can be persuaded to buy. And we all think that, you know, I'm too much of an individual, no one can predict what I want to buy, but actually they can. We really don't realize how predictable they are. So in many different everyday situations, that is something you can use.
Okay, so give me the premise, or I should say the genesis that brought you to the idea of doing the book. Was it an observation that you made about particular parts of people interacting, and whether it be online or out in the world? What was go ahead.
There were actually several inspirations. One was meeting some of these rock, paper, scissors people, but another one, when I was in college, I went to MIT, and there was a legendary professor there at that time, Claude Shannon, who was the founder of information theory. And he was not just this theoretical genius, but he was a guy who liked to build stuff with his hands. So he was always building various crazy machines, including some of the early classic attempts at artificial intelligence. And one of the things he built back in 1953 was called the outguessing machine, or it was also known as the mind-reading machine, because it really did seem like it had the ability to read minds. And it essentially played a simple game that was almost like rock, paper, scissors. The machine had on its front a switch that you could turn to the left or the right. And to play the game, you had to make a mental choice that it was either going to be left or right, but the machine would try to predict which way you were going to choose. Now, if the machine predicted correctly, it won a point. If you fooled the machine, you won a point. And you would play, you know, in succession, and the first person or the machine to get 100 points would be declared the winner. Now, in the 1950s, Shannon was working at Bell Labs, which was really the center of the tech universe at that time. So there were all these Nobel Prize-winning scientists and engineers and entrepreneurs who were constantly visiting Bell Labs. They would all be pulled into Shannon's office and challenged to play this machine. because it seemed like it should be so easy. I mean, it was this almost rock, paper, scissors game, and all you had to do to win was to be consistently unpredictable. But the machine was able to pick up on any unconscious patterns you had in your play, and if you had those patterns, it would soon beat you. And they found that no one could beat the machine, even the smartest people of the time. So it really was this demonstration that we're a lot more predictable than we think. And as I say in the book, in a very real sense, we see the consequences of that all around us. I mean, we talk about big data today, and basically all these tech companies are trying to predict, you know, our consumer behavior. And they're able to do that because we are pretty predictable.
Yeah, so that's one thing that's quite obvious in all of the news that's come out about how much data is being collected on each of us. Mm-hmm. It's just pretty remarkable. But let's go to a concrete example in your book. You have a lot of different examples that you use where people are ultimately very predictable, and that as individuals we can use that to our advantage. So one example you talk about is in testing. And I'm sure there's a lot of people in college that are going to be listening closely to this answer, but let's talk about multiple choice tests.
Yes. The professor or teacher, in making up a multiple choice test, obviously tries to make sure that the answers are in random order, or if it's true and false, that the true and falses come randomly. But that ideal is easier said than done. In fact, when they try to do that, they fall into certain very predictable patterns. And if you know these patterns, you can actually get a real statistical advantage when you have to guess on a few questions. Now, one of them, if it's a true and false test, you find that people are generally favor trues. On average, and I looked in an awful lot of archives of tests, on the average test, about 55% of the answers are true and 45% are false. Now, one reason why that probably is that it's just more effort to make up a false question. I mean, to make up a true question, you just remember a fact. To make up a false question, you have to invent a falsehood. And, you know, if you have to make up a lot of these questions, you kind of follow the path of least resistance. Another thing you find is that the answers tend to alternate more than they would in a random sequence. I mean, they tend to hopscotch true, false, with a few, you know, of the other to kind of mix it up a little. Now, if you were actually tossing a coin, you know, and translating that into true and false, you would find that there would be long streaks of trues and falses, but you hardly ever see that in an actual test. So that, again, is something you can use. I found the most effective tip of all had to do with those none of the above or all of the above answers that you get on multiple choice tests. I think a lot of people think these are kind of annoying, but actually they're very good for the student because they do give you this real edge. It turns out that, first of all, these none of the above answers can't just be dropped into a question. You basically have to write all the other possibilities around them. So since it is extra work to make these kind of questions, professors just don't invent enough false none of the above or all of the above questions to really be strategic. So what this means is that these questions are much more likely to be the correct one. So if you're in a situation where you have to guess and there is at the bottom a none of the above answer and you can't rule it out, then that's a good one to pick. And I found that in a typical test, those generally have like about a 50% chance of being correct if you've got four or five choices, which is far more than it really should be. So again, professors think they're being very clever with all this, but they do have these patterns that they're really not aware of.
Get this podcast delivered to you automatically. You can subscribe via iTunes, Stitcher, and more. You'll find the links here or on our website, digdeepgrow.com. So in a more general frame, what are the kinds of things that as you go about your day, that you could use this. Now, you could point to another example in your book. I think you mentioned passwords, for instance, using passwords on the computer. What was the idea there?
Yeah, well, of course, we're always being prompted to change our passwords. Everyone says that, you know, you should change them every month or so, and with Heartbleed, you know, everyone's looking for new passwords. The problem is that when you try to make a random password, you're really not. And with today's software, there is, you know, password cracking software that can try all sorts of possibilities. It knows the ways that people, the term is mangle, like you'll start with a word like password, and then you'll add like maybe a 1 on the end, you'll change, you know, an A to a 5 or something like that. It basically knows how our minds work. We fall into the same patterns, and it's really pretty easy to guess, you know, at least some of the passwords. Now, the best traditional advice you get is to take a phrase and convert that into a password using the first letters of the phrase. So if you think of "May the Force be with you," it would be MTFBWY. But of course you wouldn't want to use that one or any sort of common phrase. But as I say in the book, there's a lot of evidence that that's not actually such a good idea. For one thing, it's not clear that that the phrases that people come up with are really any harder to guess than the actual, you know, regular passwords. But a much better idea is to start with a truly random password. Now, there are websites and browsers that will give you a random password with, you know, letters and numbers and uppercase and lowercase, and you've seen those things. I mean, they would be ideal passwords, but they're so hard to remember. But what you find is that actually if you look at those random passwords, it's fairly easy to convert them into a phrase using the letters as an example. Of the phrase that you're going to memorize. And in that way, you use the phrase as a mnemonic, a way of jogging your memory so that you will remember that particular password. So example, if you get like, okay, you go to a website and get a random password, and it's RPM8T4KA. That would normally be very difficult to remember. But you can kind of convert that into a nonsense phrase, like revolutions per minute, 8-track for Kathy. Now, I don't really know what that means, but it is fairly easy to remember. And with that way, you can get one of these truly random passwords that's really the gold standard for security, and you can remember it. At first, I was a little skeptical of this idea, but I've tried it, and it's really pretty easy.
Okay, that's pretty good advice. Would you say do it for all sites, or, you know, create different random ones for the various sites you use?
Ideally, you would do it for all sites, but you can also just get one general password and then customize it for each site. Like, to give one example, you might take, like, the first letter of the site's name. Like, if it's Facebook, you've got an F, and append that to the end of your standard password. And again, that's much more secure than using the same password for every site.
Okay, we're talking with William Poundstone about his new book, Rock, Break, Scissors. And we're going to actually give away a copy of the book. So I'm going to be asking a question that anybody can answer, even if you have to look it up. And be doing that in about 10 minutes in our interview. So stay tuned. And again, going to be giving away a copy of the book. So William, tell me a little about the lottery. You have a chapter about the lottery in the book. Not that I play the lottery, but if you can increase my odds, I just might go do it.
Yeah, well, there was actually a professor at MIT who was quite interested in the Massachusetts number game, one of the first lotteries that were introduced in this country. And he figured that there ought to be a way of beating it mathematically. So he looked at it. You know, it was a pick six lottery. You choose your numbers, and if those numbers are drawn and if they come up, you win. But in many cases, there will be more than one winner, so you have to split the pot with them. Well, he realized that that was really the key thing here. Since most of the time the jackpots are shared, it's very important to try to avoid sharing jackpots if you possibly can. And he figured the way to do that was to choose the least possible numbers, those that were least chosen by the actual, you know, players. So he did some statistical analysis and found out what they were and published this. And he tried it, and he got, like, an amazing return on investment in, like, the first 100 days he was doing this. Since then, there have been studies of the type of lotteries we have now, and they have found that there definitely are unpopular numbers. I'll give you some of them. They are 10, 20, 29, 30, 32, 38, 39, 40 through 43, 48, 49, and 58. Now, if you choose from a set like this, there's much less of a chance that if you do win, you're going to be sharing your jackpot with someone else, because in general, people tend to choose dates or the same things, even things from fortune cookies. There was a famous case where about 20 people won, and they had all had the same fortune cookie fortune, which apparently they didn't change the numbers on them very much, and that was why they were sharing this. But if you had had one of these less popular numbers, you would have been much better off. Now, they've shown that you can actually create situations where you have a positive expectation wager. In other words, if you look at the chance of winning the lottery and the size of the jackpot, the odds are in your favor even after the lottery board takes out its, like, 30% profit. So, I mean, this is pretty amazing that by playing smart, you can actually get an advantage. But as I say in the book, there is one important caveat, and that's that nothing in this system actually changes the fact that the odds against winning with a given ticket are like 173 million to one. So you would have to keep playing the lottery for like about 2 million years before you could expect to win your first jackpot. And unfortunately, nothing in the system changes that. So the system is theoretically good, but it's really for people who like playing the lottery as entertainment and are going to play it anyway. As long as you're playing, you might as well make these positive expectation wagers.
There you go. I am not going to be running out and getting tickets, though, based on what you've said.
Yeah.
So
I think that's very wise.
Yeah. So if I was in a... let's say that I was in a bar with a friend, and we're kind of having our beers and everything, and then I want to try to see if we could play a game to see who picks up the tab. You have any ideas?
Yes, exactly. I give this psychology-based flimflam that I actually learned in college, but it's based on this psychology that I mentioned in the book. Basically, you say, as the bill comes, let's play rock, paper, scissors for it. And without waiting for an okay, you begin pumping your fist 1, 2, 3, because, of course, that's the way the game begins. You show your throw on the count of three. And there's a good chance that he's going to join in, and if he does, then you play paper. Now, the reason you do that is that it's a well-known fact that inexperienced men players at this game usually pick rock as their first throw. And this likelihood is greatly enhanced when they don't have time to think. But there is a safety net here. If for any reason you don't win that first throw, then you immediately begin pumping your fist, because you're going for 2 out of 3, of course.
Okay. So at this point, I'm going to put that question out there for a free copy of the book. And you're going to have to – it's a pretty easy question. We're talking to William Poundstone, so the first person who can email to this address, liveshow@digdeepgrow, that's liveshow@digdeepgrow, the first person to email the book prior to Rock, Break, Scissors that William Poundstone released will get the copy of the book. So just go ahead and send that email, and we will give the winner, the first person who answers that question, the free book. So, William, coming back to you, I do, although I don't play in the lottery, I do like to invest in the stock market. And one of the chapters you talk, you ask the question, can the long-term investor do better than buy and hold? Take it from there.
Yeah. As we all know, there's what's called a behavioral penalty. Most people just instinctively do the wrong things. They buy stocks when they're high. They sell them at the first dip. So you're basically buying high and selling low. And as I say, what the well-concealed scandal is that the average investor's return is much worse than the so-called average return of the stock market. Now, of course, that means that someone else is actually beating the market. And I talk about a fairly simple way to do that in the book that's based on this investor psychology. Now, if you're an average person, you probably shouldn't be buying, a whole lot of individual stocks. You're probably going to be buying low-cost index funds. But as we well know in the past decade or so, that's certainly not a bulletproof plan either, because the whole index has lost about half their value twice in the so-called lost decade. But if you look at the ways to predict that, people are looking at the trends in the stock market, and it's well known that we have this tendency to see fake trends in what's essentially random data. And there's a lot of evidence that you're not going to predict the actual high or the actual low. But there's also a lot of evidence that you can predict the future return, the long-term return of the stock market, by looking at something known as the Shiller price-earning ratio. This was devised by Yale economist Robert Shiller, and it basically looks at the average earnings of the U.S. stock market, the S&P 500, over the past 10 years, and then computes a price-earning ratio based on the current stock price. Now, on the average, it's around 16, but right now it's at 25.92, which means that stocks are seriously overvalued, even though you may well feel that, overall stocks have not been that great when you factor in these crashes we've had in the fairly recent past. But in this situation, in the past, when the valuation has been this high, the average return over the next 20 years has been only 2% above inflation, which is really pretty lousy for stocks relative to other investments. So in a situation like this, you really do want to be reducing your exposure to stocks, putting more in bonds, maybe some in foreign stocks, maybe some in real estate investment trust index funds. And it's maybe a little too elaborate to go into in the book, but I give a system that that does do that in a very sensible way. It's very easy to use for anyone who's got a 401k, an IRA, where you can sell without, triggering capital gains taxes.
Okay. I'm going to ask you a couple more questions before we end. You have two main parts in the book. One is called The Hot Hand Theory. Can you talk about all of the chapters that are under that heading? What does that mean, the hot hand theory?
Yes, this is a famous idea from basketball. For years, fans have noticed that there seem to be these incredible hot streaks of NBA players. In other words, someone will, like LeBron James, will start making a basket, and it seems he'll make basket after basket. Every attempt seems to work. And it seems like that these streaks are just too long to be just a coincidence. It seems that really some sort of magical effect is going on. Well, in 1985, a group of psychologists actually examined this really exhaustively from every angle. And they found that it was basically just a cognitive illusion. We perceive these streaks as being remarkable, but really the streaks that you see in basketball are no longer than you would expect for a random sequence, like, say, tossing a coin. It's not unusual to have, say, a coin come up six heads in a row, and so it's really not that unusual for a player to make six baskets in a row. But somehow our minds are just wired that we think that this has to be something special, that it can't just be chance. Now, this illusion has become kind of the prototype of a very general illusion that applies to all sorts of things. I just mentioned the stock market, where the day-to-day movements really are just chance. But people think they can see patterns, they try to trade on those patterns, and they end up losing a lot of money. But it applies to a lot of different things. I talk about sports betting, like basketball bracket pools, office football pools, Oscar pools. I talk about how it applies to home prices, retail prices, really a lot of the things that that you deal with every day.
Okay. The last area that I'm going to ask you about is you talk about when people go online, they try to seek out the opinions of others before they buy a product, for instance. So we'll call those crowdsource ratings. What are a couple of tips in that area where it will help people to make a good decision when making purchases online?
Yeah, I mean, of course, these crowdsource ratings have become incredibly important, and you know, every restaurateur, you know, tries to get people to give good reviews. But what people don't realize is that when it's in a situation where you don't quite know how many stars to give, like it's either 1 out of 10 or 5 stars, there's a strong tendency to pick the choice that's about 70% of the maximum. So that would be like maybe 3 or 4 stars out of 5. Or a 7 out of 10 if you're, say, in a focus group. So the important thing here is that if you see a restaurant that's 3 stars, that's really not anything too impressive. You should, you know, really have a baseline there and understand that you're going to get a lot of reviews like that. And it doesn't necessarily mean very much. I talk about, you know, a lot of companies try to do focus groups or something to decide if a product is going to sell. And when someone gives a product a 7, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to rush out and buy that product. It may mean, you know, it's okay. I want to, you know, people naturally want to say what they think the person wants to hear. And in that context, 7 may not really mean anything. Much more significant are the valuations at the extremes. If someone says it's a 10, that probably means they're enthusiastic about it and would actually buy it. So probably the number of perfect 10 ratings may be more meaningful than the average rating, which includes a lot of 7s. If you're really trying to decide, is this a product that's going to sell a lot? Is this going to go viral?
Yeah, I personally, for me, if I'm, for instance, on Amazon.com, I do tend to look at the number of 5-star ratings rather than the 4s and the 3s. The average. It just seems to work out better when I do it that way. Okay, so the book is Rock, Break, Scissors, and the entire title goes Rock, Break, Scissors, A Practical Guide to Outguessing and Outwitting Almost Everybody. And that is by William Poundstone. You can pick that up at Amazon or any other major bookseller. So, William, I thank you for coming on the show today, and appreciate your taking the time. We'll look forward to your next book.
Okay, great. Thanks a lot.
Very good.